Beacon Press Audio presents Uncertain Peril, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Seeds by Claire Hope Cummings. This audiobook is narrated by David Henry. Published by Beacon Press Audio, 2018.
For we have forgotten this, that the earth is a star of grass, a seed planet, swirling with spores as with clouds from sea to sea. A whirl of them. Seeds take hold under the cobblestones and between the letters in my poem. Here they are. From Green Light by Rolf Jacobsen. Translated from the Norwegian by Roger Greenwald. A note on the terminology. I use the words biotechnology and genetic engineering interchangeably, along with the references to transgenics and to GMOs, or genetically modified organisms. In all cases, I'm referring to recombinant DNA technology, as it is used to breed new organisms by crossing species boundaries. I'm not using the term biotechnology in its general sense, which can include natural processes. This analysis focuses exclusively on genetic engineering as it is used in agriculture. Genetic engineering has many other applications, particularly in medicine. Some of the arguments made here may apply to those uses, but only coincidentally. Last, sometimes I refer to plants and seeds as if they were the same, which of course they are not. In some cases, where I was unable to make a finer point, I resorted to generalizations. Some of these generalizations will rankle experts, and for that, I apologize in advance. Preface. Yet, in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. President Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961. Wheeler Hall, University of California, Berkeley. The audience was growing restive. Inside the darkened auditorium were some of the world's most eminent scientists, biotechnology's wealthiest entrepreneurs, the press, and invited guests. It was March 1999, and they had gathered to celebrate the first 25 years of biotechnology. The keynote speaker was the famous James D. Watson, who, along with Francis Crick, first described the double helix structure of DNA. Everyone wanted to hear Watson's reminiscences about the early years of molecular biology, but he was having problems getting started. He spent the first 10 minutes of his speech trying to get a slide to focus. He kept ordering the technicians around and making lame jokes about Berkeley being a liberal arts school. Watson, who was then in his early 70s, began getting peevish. Finally, he moved on. But for the rest of the time he spoke, he had worked up a lather in his mouth that made him sound like he was speaking underwater. He kept making breathy gurgling noises into the microphone and nervously laughing at his own jokes. His speech turned into a rambling collection of fascinating details about how scientific discoveries are made, mixed in with gratuitous swipes at prominent colleagues. He told stories about personalities and academic infighting, and threw in strange asides about women's bodies and left-wing loonies. He said, "We are immensely better off because we didn't listen to the Friends of the Earth, the Sierra Club, all these people who just wanted us to prove that what we were doing was safe before we do it." The remarkable thing about Watson's speech that day was not so much that his quirky personality was on display. It was what he said about the role of science in society. The telling moment came as he was recalling the first recombinant DNA experiments. At the time, scientists were using tumor viruses and E. coli bacteria to cut genetic material from one organism and insert it into another. Watson acknowledged that early on, scientists had concerns about the safety of those experiments. He said they all felt that Nobel laureate Joshua Lederberg had it right when he said genetic engineering held both certain promise and uncertain peril. Now, however, Watson was unequivocal. He said that this technology held such certain promise that it should not be constrained by fears of uncertain peril. Watson expressed his disdain for the controversy this technology was causing and urged his colleagues to disregard the critics. Instead of explaining why he chose certain promise over uncertain peril, He mocked concerns about this technology and the people who expressed them. In some ways, he was simply saying out loud what many in the audience already thought. Watson was also defending his own role in promoting the development of recombinant DNA technology and his antipathy toward public debate. Although he didn't dwell on the part he played in marginalizing the public, he was there when the decisions were made. In 1973, just as recombinant DNA technology was beginning to be developed, the scientific community met to discuss safety concerns at the Asilomar Conference Center in Pacific Grove, California. They wanted to discuss, in private, a way to develop a system of voluntary controls that would leave scientists in charge of oversight. Then, in February 1975, a larger and more public meeting was held at Asilomar. By then, serious safety issues were emerging, including the possibility of uncontrolled experiments, mutant viruses, new pathogens, and threats to human health. It was a rare collective discussion by scientists involved in a new technology, but it was by no means open-ended. Those who attended were not so much concerned with public safety as they were determined to forestall a larger, potentially more acrimonious public debate over the risks of genetic engineering. According to science historian Susan Wright, the assembled scientists decided that they would be self-regulating. They believed that they could come up with the technological fixes for any problems that might arise, and they preserved for themselves the exclusive right to define, regulate, and benefit from genetic engineering. There was, according to Wright, virtual unanimity for this idea. She said it bore, within it, the seeds of a technological solution expressed in personal and economic interests. These decisions created a central role for the research community in policymaking, to the exclusion of society in general. From then on, Wright says, this reductionist discourse became dogma and eventually defined the boundaries of the public's role in genetic engineering. As a result of this one remarkable meeting, which occurred long before the products of genetic engineering were commercialized, there has never been a public debate about the risks and benefits of this revolutionary new technology. Watson's speech at Berkeley ended with the enthusiastic applause of his colleagues. For his part, Watson was not simply betraying his own cynicism about the role of the public. He was revealing a much deeper animus that underlies genetic engineering and all its progeny, the age-old idea that mankind is entitled to control the natural world. And it reveals a more subtle foe, the danger to our democracy that comes from any diminution of the public discourse. The right to choose what we eat and to know what is in our food is a fundamental human freedom. But the decisions made at Asilomar by men like Watson undermined the role of the public and our government in securing our environmental health and public safety. Agricultural biotechnology was commercialized without regard to these important citizen and consumer rights. This is the soft tyranny of the technological elite. James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, warned us that our liberty was at stake when we no longer participated in decisions about something as fundamental as what we eat, when he said, "A popular government without popular information or the means to acquire it is a prologue to a farce, or a tragedy, or perhaps both. It is most definitely the path of uncertain peril." Introduction. Spitsbergen Island, Svalbard, Norway. On a frozen island near the North Pole, a huge hole has been blasted out of the side of an Arctic mountain, and a tunnel has been drilled deep into the rock. When the facility under construction here is completed, it will be lined with 1 meter thick concrete, fitted with 2 high-security blast-proof airlock doors, and built to withstand nuclear war, global warming, terrorism, and the collapse of the Earth's energy supplies. It's known as the Doomsday Vault, and in it will be stored millions of seeds in mankind's hope for the future of the world's food supply. The idea is that in the event of massive ecological destruction, those seeds could be used to reconstruct the planet's agricultural systems. Exactly who might remain to begin replanting the Earth after such a catastrophe is only one of the questions this astounding project raises. The more immediate question is, are seeds in peril? The answer is yes, especially the seeds that provide us with food, fiber, and fuel. both the diversity and the integrity of
sample complete. Ready to continue?